Hello and welcome to the Peter A. Allard School of Law History Project. My name is Alexander Starr and I am the History Project Student Coordinator. Today I'm interviewing Anne Stewart of the class of 1975. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Could you please tell us a bit about yourself?
Okay, a small town girl. I'm from Nelson, British Columbia. My dad was born there. My mother was born just outside of town but spent all her schooling in Nelson. Graduated from L.V. Rogers High School, and I'm just about to go back to my 49th reunion. We're having 2 years together, so the other year gets to have it their 50th, and it's just our 49th. And it's so scary because it does not seem anywhere close to 49 years. At the time I graduated, I knew I did not want to stay in Nelson as much as I loved it, and it still is home, and it's still where I say I'm from. I wanted a chance to get out into the world a little more. My mother desperately wanted me to go to UVic because she thought it was smaller and safer. Luckily, I didn't get into residence in UVic, so I got to go to UBC and came down and registered in science, did my Bachelor of Science in mathematics, started out doing a triple honors in math, chemistry, and physics, which lasted about 2.5 weeks because after the first weekend where I thought I'd worked really hard by putting a couple of hours in on Friday night and then going and having a good time and about 8 hours on Saturday, which I thought was more than enough, and probably about the same on Sunday, I came back to class on Monday morning feeling kind of proud of myself to hear these people that had basically not slept the entire weekend working. And I thought, you know, there's got to be more to life in university than this. So I dropped the triple honors, which was crazy, and went back to just do my math degree, which was a really good decision.
Wow.
So went through, did my Bachelor of Science. When I was going into my fourth year, I started thinking that really that it was time to plan what was going to come next. So I thought about going into medicine. I was invited into medicine. I would have had to pick up some biology. I had all the other science courses, but not biology. So I would have had to pick up some biology. I thought about teaching math in university, so I would have done my master's. I thought of teaching it in high school, which would have been my education degree. And I, although my dad was involved in the land title office, so we had, you know, legal stuff in the house, I'd actually never met a lawyer. So the beginning of my fourth year of my Bachelor of Science degree, I talked myself into taking Commerce 331, which was commercial law. In science, the only electives you were allowed to take were science electives and arts electives, and this was a commerce elective. So I registered anyhow and figured I'd find some way to convince them that it was a really good idea. And I still, they actually didn't okay it until into October, and I'm still not sure what I would have done if they said no. I would have been a class short to graduate, and I would have had to really scramble in the spring term to pick up 3 units then. But they did say yes, and I took the class, and I absolutely loved it. It was little bit of negligence and some torts at the beginning, and the rest of the whole year was contract law, and I loved it. Still, some of my friends now, some of my clients now, were from that class. So that was how I ended up going into law school. After taking that class, I did my LSATs and registered and got in. It wasn't the issue getting into law school. That I had very good marks, and coming from science, it was an advantage because you can get much higher marks in science than you can in a lot of arts courses. You can write a perfect math paper, you can't write a perfect essay. So I had good marks and got in and came into first year. One of the 120 first year students, and I was in section one, and we were the best section. What can I say? If anybody's listening to this from section 2, 3, and 4, I'll still say section 1's the best. So.
Heard that from every section.
I'm sure you all did. I'm sure you did.
It's interesting. You sort of had a taste of law, and that was it. You were kind of hooked. Do you remember your first impressions of coming into the law school?
I totally do. I thought it was scary. Coming in, I can remember being in the old library, which was the only nice building we had at the law school at that time, and it was a very impressive library with huge windows that looked right out down onto the water, and it was quite a gorgeous building, and we were all lined up in the corridor around it. And I can remember a few thoughts. One was one student who shall remain nameless, a woman, being fairly loud about how she wanted to be, she was going to be a great female lawyer. That's what she wanted. She was going to show everybody that women could be lawyers. And I can remember sitting there in line thinking, you know, I just want to be the best lawyer I can be. I don't want to be the best female lawyer. I want to be the best lawyer. I don't want this to be a gender-based experience. I can remember that thought very clearly on my first day. And then I can remember listening to all these people, and you know, the first thing you do when you're standing in line is you try to talk to people. And there was the people from political science, and there was the people that had their business degrees, and there were people with economics degrees, and all these things that I thought were going to be so much more valuable to them than my science degree. And I'm thinking, oh, what am I doing here? Maybe this isn't the best idea. But I stuck it out, and it actually turned out that the science background, I think, was really useful for me. It taught step-by-step thinking. It taught logic. Writing a science exam or anything to do with science, you can't just jump from A to Z. You clearly have to show B, C, D, E, and all the steps along the way. But if you wrote a paper and you got the right answer, but you didn't show how you got there, you basically didn't get anything. So that kind of step-by-step thinking, some of the other science courses, they wouldn't necessarily give you all the facts, so you get to a point and you'd say, well, if this is true, then this is what happens, but if this is true, then this is what happens. And that's exactly the way it works in law. It's the same kind of thinking process to go through. So I think it was very useful.
Was it?
So, but that first day was pretty darn scary.
Yeah.
It was.
Was it frustrating to go from science, where you could get a perfect paper, to law, where that perfect paper
there was no hope?
There was no hope?
No, it wasn't. It was the main thing I can remember at that time was that it was pretty scary. We had Peter Burns for criminal law, mm-hmm. and he basically, that first day, I can remember it so clearly, he had us all terrified of what law school was going to be like, and that nothing we knew before was going to help us. And Peter ended up becoming a friend. In fact, he worked at Blake's for a while, and I still keep in touch with Peter and his wife. So you just never know how it's going to work out.
Wow. You've mentioned Peter Burns already. Do you remember any other professors from your time at law school?
Sure, several. Dean McLean was the dean at the time, mm-hmm. and he was so wonderful to all of us. He was great. Joost Blom, who
just retired.
Yes. We were his first class. My section one had him for contracts, and we were the first class that he had in the first year that he taught. And I keep in touch with him still as well. We teach ethics courses together. We were on the ethics committee of the Law Society,
yes.
for quite a while, and we still teach ethics courses together. And so whenever I get a chance, I tell everybody that we were his best class ever. So other people may take me to task on that one too, but I think he'd support me. We were there when Bob DeBolt and Barry Slutsky were there. They were kind of a fun twosome to be around. Bob DeBolt would walk into class, especially on Monday morning, looking a little worse for wear, but still teach a phenomenal class. And Slutsky would kind of look like the same all the time. I hope he doesn't listen to this, or I could be in trouble. But the great, great professors. Some other memories from law school. We had, when I was in first year, there was an absolutely great group of people in third year that were very close. And one of them had rented a house, 911 Nicola, which is right downtown, just over from the Landmark Hotel. And that was the party house. And we had some absolutely amazing parties there with great music. And we'd go down. I remember going down there one time and cooking Thanksgiving dinner for several of the people, and then not for everybody at the party, but then the party opened up afterwards. So it was a fun time. We had a good mix of the serious and the fun. We had, at law school at that time, bridge was a big deal. There were people would go into the common area and
the card game.
Card game.
Okay.
And I never did that. I was more, if I had any free time, I was more interested in just talking to people.
Yeah.
We had one funny thing that happened in law school, which I will mention again without mentioning any names. There was a payphone in the bottom of the building where the library was, which, as I said, was the only nice building that we had at the time. There was a payphone there. So you could, there were no cell phones, okay? Mm-hmm. Like, just
yeah,
imagine.
You needed a
payphone. Can you
pay
just
phone.
Imagine you needed a payphone? Tried to convince them to give us a free phone, but they gave us a payphone. So it was down the bottom of this staircase, and you had to go past it to go to the men's washroom or the women's washroom. So there were always people on this phone and lined up to make phone calls. And I don't know who happened to figure out that this phone was not properly grounded, and that if you took a, opened up a paper clip and you put one clip, part of the clip, against the phone, and you put the other part of the clip through the mouthpiece so it hit metal, you didn't have to pay. So all of the law students knew this, and this went on for quite a while, and we thought this was all pretty funny. I'm sure the as it was then, BC Tel people, when they came out and checked this phone, couldn't understand why there wasn't very much money in it. There would have been some. Probably not everybody knew about it. But then one day somebody came down and they were in a real hurry to make this phone call, and they get out the paperclip and they do this and start making the phone call and turn around, and it's the BC Tel repairman standing right behind them. So the phone was fixed and we didn't get to do that anymore.
Oh no. And then you were on the ethics committee. Did you end up doing anything sort of outside the school that you remember from your time during law school? Any extracurricular activities or traditions?
Not too much extracurricular activities. As I say, the getting together with various friends down at 9/11 NICLA was fun. There's not a lot of extra time in law school. I was at that time hitchhiking back and forth to school, which people would not do now. It was actually considered, we all did it. And so
I'm sure your mother and Nelson was.
Oh, I don't know that she ever knew, actually. I'm not sure she ever knew. But people just, that's what everybody did. That's how you got to UBC from wherever you were in Vancouver. If you weren't in residence, you were hitchhiking. And, you know, probably 90% of the time it was another student that picked you up. But between getting to school and studying, there wasn't a whole bunch left. I still tried to get back. If I had a spare weekend and could fit something in, I tried to go back to Nelson, where my family was. And so there wasn't time for a whole bunch of extracurricular activities. Most of my social structure at that time was around people in law school. Some old friends that were here, but mostly people in law school.
You mentioned a classmate who was adamant about being the best female lawyer, and that wasn't, your concern was more just about being the best lawyer. Did you find that there were additional challenges because you're female?
In law school?
In law school, sorry.
Not really. Something is only a challenge if you let it be.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always chosen, whether it's law school or in practice, to not let something be a challenge, because they often, even if it might, if you don't think it is, they often fall away. So I've never felt discrimination mm-hmm. in law school. I haven't really felt it very often in practice since then. My class was the first class that had a really large percentage of women. It was an exponential curve, that's my math background, that was like a big hockey stick. So there were 6 1 year and about 25 the next year, and then we had over 50 students in our class that were women. I think that was the right number. In the graduating class, 7 of the top 11 I think were women, which was pretty good.
Yeah.
Given I mean, that was way more than our proportionate share of people in the top 11. And I'm making it 11 because the 11th was a woman, so that makes it sound better. But yeah, that was pretty good. And 4 of us in that top 7 were on one moot court team, so that was something that was, we had a bit of an audience that night.
I guess that's, I mean, it's not so extracurricular, but MOOCs weren't for credit when you were at UBC, were they?
They were required,
okay.
It was a pass-fail.
Yeah.
So you had to do it. But, we had...
Yeah. And so do you remember your MOOC team or your MOOC problem?
I remember, we had two of them.
Okay.
I can remember the first one we did, and it was, there's a case called Somebody and the City of White Rock that was to do with somebody putting in a pool at the top of a hill and water coming down, and it was sort of, it was a negligence case. But it was an actual case, which I think it had been argued but not reported on or something, but it ended up being an actual case. So that was one of the two moots that we did. I actually can't remember the second one right now.
Okay.
But
that's interesting.
I do have to tell you one other story from law school.
Please do.
So it's a beautiful law school now, right? It's
mm-hmm.
gorgeous. It was not always that way. When I went there, we had the nice building that was the library, and then all the administration was down in the old Fort Camp, which was below the road.
Right.
And there were a couple classrooms down there, and then there were, I think, three huts behind the library building. And they were pretty bad. Like, they were from the war days, the original UBC buildings. And they were pretty bad. And one Monday morning, we came in, and the huts had all been painted. The inside of the huts were all painted, all different colors. So there would be a red table and a blue table and a green table and a yellow table, and all the chairs were different colors, and everything was painted. We all loved it. I'm not sure UBC was all that happy about it. We thought it was hilarious. And the group of people, which did not include me, it's never been determined exactly who that group was.
Wow.
So kind of fun.
That's good to find ways to liven up those buildings.
Well, and it didn't hurt anybody, right? They were all going to be torn down. So right after we graduated is when they tore all that down and put in that gray cement building that nobody really liked. And then that led to the beautiful new building, which is spectacular. It's gorgeous. I love going out there to teach courses or something. Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah, it's a I feel so lucky to study there. It's beautiful. You've come back and taught at UBC, and you've also given a lot of your time as a mentor. Were there mentorship opportunities for you during your early career?
To
be mentor?
No, not really.
And then so...
Wasn't even a word then. I can't remember that word ever coming up. Certainly in law school, there wasn't that feeling. When I got into practice, the very beginning of my practice, there was a woman by the name of Lucille Johnston who became the president of RIVTO. I don't know if do you still study the RIVTO case in law school? It's
the RIVTO Marine,
Walker Machinery,
yeah.
And Washington Ironworks. I don't remember many cases. I just remember that one because it's RIVTO. And she was vice president at that time and ended up becoming the president of RIVTO. And I still do work for the successor company, but I met her in the first, I'm going to say month, but I think it was actually less than a month. I think it was almost the first week of my articles. And she definitely became my mentor.
Yeah.
So I got it then, and two other people. I was at Davis. I articled at Davis. And two other people there in particular were also mentors to me, David Hosey and John Pearson, and they were fantastic. So, yes, I got mentored. I don't remember anything in particular in law school.
Right. What sort of drove you to then serve as a mentor for others?
When I was getting into my practice, which was a corporate commercial practice, buying and selling businesses and financings, there were not a lot of women doing that kind of work. And again, I thought, that doesn't matter. But there were various times in your career where you sort of think, it would be nice to talk to somebody that has had this experience before. Try to balance the rest of your life with a law practice. I never got married, so I didn't have that issue, and I haven't had children, so I didn't have that issue. But I was still trying to balance friends and family back in Nelson and other demands on me, and just to talk to somebody that kind of understood. And there weren't a lot of role models for women lawyers, especially in the sort of the larger corporate commercial transaction type practices. So that's partly how I got into doing it. It's sort of hopefully be a bit of a role model for people coming up behind.
Interesting. You work specifically with the Minerva Foundation for BC Women.
Yeah.
Could you tell us about this organization?
Sure, happy to. So it's an organization that's been around for over 10 years. It was formed by Nancy McKinstry and a group of her friends who felt a need to help raise money for organizations to support women in areas of security, leadership, education. There were basically four pillars at the beginning. The initial concept of the organization was to raise funds to donate to other organizations that were actually providing the services, and then fairly quickly it decided it wanted to be providing the services as well. So they've had some absolutely amazing programs. There's a there was a program called Learning to Lead that was for grade 11 girls from all across the province to come and spend a weekend with more senior leaders and understand what leadership means. And I participated in that quite a few times. That's an incredible experience because you start to realize that these grade 11 girls are amazing. The things that they have done, the pressure they put on themselves is incredible. They were so driven and so focused. It was fantastic. So that was one of their programs. They had a program called Leading the Way, which was for women in their career, but not all the way along in their career, but who had demonstrated leadership skills and wanted to ramp that up to the next level of leadership ability. So everywhere from mid-30s to 45-ish, that was another program that they had. I helped them start a program which has since gone away, but called Minerva Helping Women Work, which was to help women that had women in executive or professional positions who had left the workplace, either because of family reasons, you know, marriage, children, caregiving to family members or parents, or a lot of the people turned out to be people moving to Canada and who had left phenomenal careers behind and just couldn't get established here. So that program was designed to help those women reintegrate into the workforce. And that was a really exciting program to be involved in. I'll give you one example. There was a woman from India, and she had been teaching in the faculty of medicine in India, very successful. Her husband had a great job there. The two daughters desperately wanted to come to Canada. So the parents said, okay, we'll take you to Canada. She came to Canada. Neither of them could get a job that was anywhere close to what they had before. She went to one immigrant placement agency, and they said, well, if she was really lucky, maybe they could help her get a job in a laundromat. And she's thinking, huh? She had her doctorate.
She taught medicine, yeah.
Yeah, taught medicine. And so they were just about ready to give up, and the daughters were so upset. And she heard about the Minerva program, and she went and applied and got into Minerva Helping Women Work. And when she finished, she got a job at UBC Medicine.
Wow.
So there were a lot of those kinds of stories. They were very, very heartwarming. So we started that program. They did that for quite a while. And then these things sort of run their course, and different organizations start offering some of the same services. So the latest one that I've been involved in at Minerva is Leaders in Transition.
Right. You developed the program and sort of...
Developed that one, too, with two amazing women, Helen Dewar and Joanne Lauser. And that's a program to help women like me. I had a selfish interest in getting this one up and running because I took the program. Women that had, you know, really devoted themselves more than full time to a career, How do you then transition from that into the next chapter, the third act, refirement? There's all these words instead of retirement, because most of us don't want to retire.
Yeah.
We're not ready to retire. We've got lots of skills and energy and interests and abilities, and still almost all the people that have taken the program still have this real desire to give back, to be valuable, to be valued members of our community.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what that program has been about. We've had three cohorts go through that, and the last one just finished last Friday. The last day of the third cohort just finished last Friday. So that was a great program too. And they have another program called Combining Our Strengths, which is a program that Minerva offers with First Nations women. And that's been going for several years, and that's a big part also what Minerva does. So it's a great organization. We used to have, I was on the board for a whole bunch of time, and was vice chair as well. And then since then I've been on the governance committee. I'm on their, used to be called Patrons Circle, it's now an honorary advisor, and I'm still very active in that organization. Very, very good organization.
You admitted that Leaders in Transition was a little bit of a selfish start for you.
Totally,
as well.
Totally.
How, I mean, I guess maybe just your personal perspective, how did the program affect you, or how did that program really give you the insight for what's become your refirement?
Right. Probably the most important thing about it was taking time to think about it, and taking time to think about it in advance, although I didn't think about it nearly as much in advance as I should have. But you know, you're so busy in your career and all your day-to-day activities, and it's kind of like Stephen Covey with his urgent and important, that you know, you're so busy dealing with the urgent that sometimes you don't think about the things that are actually more important. And I think what you want to do after your career, first career, is something you kind of, at least I was putting it off. Some people are way better than I am, but it was something I didn't want to face. I love doing what I do, and I love my clients, and I love practicing law, and I just didn't want to think about something else. So it forced me to think about it. So the program was one Friday a month for 6 months, and different topics each time, topics to do with health, topics to do with financial, topics to do with relationships, be they in your family or friends, and sort of a recognition that especially relationships that came from work, that they're going to change, they're going to morph, and you're going to have some new friends, old friends that drop away, old friends that continue. So, but really just to take that time to think about something that's really important. So that was probably the most value to me.
Wow. You mentioned your practice in mostly corporate commercial, being buying and selling companies and financing. Could you tell us about how that area of law has changed over your career, or the differences you've experienced throughout practice?
Okay, can I tell you first how I got into it?
Yeah,
okay.
That would be even more interesting. Yeah.
So those three mentors that I told you about, Lucille Johnston, David Hosey, John Pearson, Lucille was a client. The other two were corporate commercial lawyers at Davis, where I articled. So one of the things that I would recommend to all young lawyers is to find some champions, find some people that will give them work, will train them, will be there when you have questions to answer, really key. And those three people were absolutely invaluable to me. And what you will tend to do is your area of practice will tend to be in the area where your champions are, because that's, they're helping you, you like them, you tend to learn more about what they do. So that's partly how I ended up in corporate commercial law. The other was that I really like people to get along and things to work out. I like conciliation and negotiation way more than I like confrontation. So my personality was much more suited to being a solicitor than a litigator. You know, in a solicitor's practice, you've got differences of opinion with somebody on the other side, but you're at least going towards the same ultimate goal. You've got a business to sell, I've got a business, I want to buy a business, so we'll have little wrinkles along the way as we try to get to that closing, but at least the goal is common. You want to sell,
yeah,
and I want to buy. And in litigation, it's not that way so much, or at all.
Yeah.
It's much more confrontational, and I just was not comfortable with that. That was not my personality. So I think you have to recognize, as an individual, where your strengths lie and try and orient yourself there. So I was really lucky. I through those people and through Lucille, I had amazing clients from day one of my practice. Quite a few of them are still clients. I've got clients now that I started working with in the first month of my articles. And that's really important to me. In addition to those ones, which were very much relationship type clients, I've had some amazing transactional clients where you do this great big phenomenal transaction and there's all this adrenaline and it's all exciting and you have this closing and you haven't slept for a while because you're just trying to get it all done, and then you go back to these clients that you've had since your articles. And so it's been a great mix that way. The large transactional clients transactions have been really exciting, but it's just been so important to me to also have these relationships that have gone on for that long. I was at a dinner, I got an award from the YWCA Women of Distinction on May 29th, and at the table was one client who's with the company that I've been with acting for over 40 years. Another one was the brother of someone I went to law school with, and she referred him to me in the beginning of my articles, and I've acted for him ever since. Another one was previously one of my partners at Davis, so I'd known and then worked with him for over 30 years. He became a client when he left Davis. And the other one was a really new client because he'd only been a client since 1991.
Yeah.
Like, really? That was...
Yeah, that's your new...
He wasn't the newest. He was the second newest because there was one more who's been a client since in the infrastructure area, which I've been doing for the last 15 years or so. So she was the actual newbie. But just to be sitting at a table with people that, I've had that long a relationship with. So they...
Yeah.
When you do that, they're much more than just clients. They're friends. You know their families. You know how they think about things. You're a trusted advisor, and that's really important to me. And that I found really came from the solicitor side of the practice. That I was in most things, even if it was litigation, I was the initial kind of go-to person for them, and then I might call in the litigator or call in the tax person or call in the environmental person, but I was the one that was sort of the running the show and being the connection to that client, and I love that. So starting about 2004, I started doing infrastructure work. We did, the very first one was the SYD project, was Sierra Yo-Yo Desan Road out of Fort Nelson. That was the first P3, public-private partnership,
right,
project to close in British Columbia, so that was exciting. I got that. You never know how work's going to come, and you never know how the direction your career's going to go in. So,
where did that one come from?
I'll tell you. And it's another lesson learned is to keep your mind really open for possibilities because you really don't know. I knew nothing. I didn't even know what a P3 was. In January of 2004, it was the first day back after Christmas, a couple days off for Christmas, New Year's. And the phone rang, and it was a lawyer at a financing company in Toronto that they were financing this Sierra Yo-Yo Desan Road. It was a P3, and did I want to act? And he'd phoned me, and he'd phoned somebody else in our firm at the same time. And I made the phone call back first, so I got to do it. The other person I involved in it as well, but I got to do it. And I found out what P3s were. I found out that they were largely being modeled in Canada off the ones done in the UK and Australia because they were a little bit ahead of us. So that first one that we did, none of us really knew what we were doing. The people acting for the government, the people acting for the proponent, or I was acting for the lenders, and we were all just kind of doing the best we could and going back to first principles. But it was really exciting. We had to get it done. It was really important to the government. Gordon Campbell, who was the premier at the time, had promised that one of these transactions was going to close, and it did, and it was really exciting. And then I worked on some other amazing projects right after that, Sea to Sky Highway, and we advised one of the proponents for Golden Years Bridge. I've done a whole bunch of hospitals. I worked on Canada Line, Waterloo, Light Rapid Transit, all kinds of things. It's been really, really exciting. So most of the big infrastructure projects that have been done as P3s in Canada, I've been sort of directly or indirectly involved in them, and it's been really exciting. And it's, we went in British Columbia, in particular, Canada in general, we went from, you know, trying to figure out how to do these transactions by reading precedents from the UK to really being world leaders in these projects.
Because, sorry, just to understand, at the start, so the first one in 2004, there was new legislation.
Wasn't legislation. It was done just contractually here. There, a lot of the jurisdictions in the states, it did require legislation to be able to enter into that kind of a project. Here, we didn't have to. Municipalities, there were some issues at that time. Municipalities could only enter into five-year contracts, but the provincial or the federal government or crown corporations could enter into these, could do these projects.
So then it was figuring out the pathways. And,
and they're big projects. Yeah. Canada Line was, what, $8.6 or $7 billion, and they're huge.
Giant tunnels,
and very exciting.
Wow.
And so that practice, the infrastructure practice, is still very important in British Columbia, and it's still changing.
There's huge projects that happen in BC just in terms of transportation and power and all of that kind of.
Yeah, schools, hospitals, there's water, wastewater, there's a lot of projects that are done. Anytime you've got a public asset and it needs something done to it, either it needs to be built or it needs to be refurbished or whatever, you can look at whether a P3 makes sense. Education facilities, how they work is that it remains a government-owned asset, but they give the right to design, build, finance, and operate it for a specified period of time, or just design, build, and finance it, or design, build, finance, operate, but they don't have to do life cycle. There's different ways you can design them. Most of the ones in BC that are, there's been a few design, build, finance ones where once it's finished, the government takes it back, but a lot of the ones in BC have been design, build, finance, operate. So they're being operated for about 30 years after substantial completion. And one of the really great things about them is that the time you do the contract, the project code covenants to provide, to return that asset to the government, to maintain it to a certain condition, but more importantly, to return it to the government at the end of the term in a certain condition. And that condition is defined by the contract. So in a hospital, for example, it might say that the roof has to be good for 15 years at the time you turn it back, and the HVAC system has to be good for 12 years, and the floors have to be good for 8.5 years.
Yeah.
And that's the condition that it must be turned back in, and starting generally about 5 years before the end of that period, that's all monitored. And if an independent engineer doesn't think that Project Co is on track to having it in that condition, they start withholding funds to make sure that if it's not in the proper condition at the end, that it will be put in that condition. So one of the things that's, you know, you hear about life cycle deficit. Yeah. One of the reasons for that is that, you know, if you've got limited funds as a government and you've got a choice between building something and maintaining something else, well, certain operating expenses you have to do, and there's certain maintenance that you have to do, but you don't necessarily have to replace a roof at the best time to replace a roof, and you don't necessarily have to do some of the bigger maintenance projects, so it's easy to defer those. Well, in this type of transaction, P3, at a certain point in time, they will not be deferred anymore. They will have to be done. So it's been great.
No, that's interesting.
On Portman Highway 1, so a lot of ones I've worked on them from BC all the way to New Brunswick.
Hmm. That's cool.
Yeah, it is cool.
That is cool.
It's something I'm very proud of.
You mentioned celebrating the YWCA Women of Distinction Award, and you have been recognized so many times. You've been recognized as one of Canada's most powerful women by the Women's Executive Network, one of Canada's top 25 women lawyers by Lexpert. UBC recognizes you as a distinguished alumni. It's definitely easy to find a reason to praise you. Considering your career, though, are there memories that bring you the most pride?
I'd have to say the most one is still working with people that I worked with right from the very beginning. The fact that those relationships have continued would be the most important thing to me. In terms of particular transactions, one that I really remember fondly, again, it was one where we didn't really know what we were doing because it hadn't been done before, and that was the privatization, which then became commercialization when the lingo changed, and now it's back okay to call it privatization of the Vancouver Airport. And I got involved in that through a contact that I had with CIBC. A guy named John Goldsmith was kind of acting as an advisor to he was with CIBC. There was a task force set up. Lucille Johnson was also a member of that, to try and look at this, what they could do to the airport. Could they privatize it? And John with CIBC got involved in helping them figure out some of the aspects for financing. And CIBC at that time, and I still think this is absolutely incredible, they loaned money to a task force, which was not a legal entity. So it was just a good faith, you know, we think this is going to go okay and that you're going to pay back this money. So I still think that's amazing of a bank to do that, to do the research that was necessary to see if this would go. So one of the things that he knew that any lender was going to want was to have independent, a technical advisor and an insurance advisor to look at various aspects of the project. So he asked me if I would, on a voluntary basis, draft the terms of reference for a technical advisor and an insurance advisor to just advise on this concept. So I said, well, I've never done that before because it hadn't been done before in this kind of context. But I said, sure, I'll do my best. And then when the Airport Authority was incorporated and they were doing the transaction for the privatization of the airport, CIBC loaned the money, and they asked me to act. So I was acting for CIBC as the lender in that transaction. And it was really exciting. It was the initial loan was not very much because all that was really being paid for were some old fire trucks and equipment at the airport, because it was all a lease, so they weren't buying the land, they weren't buying the buildings, but it was the whole setup of the Airport Authority. And then we did several follow-up transactions. We did the new parkade up that's still up there now. That was a separate transaction. And then the international terminal and the third runway was another transaction. So I got to see all these changes in the airport. And I still go out there and I look around and I think, there's a little piece of me out here somewhere. Little pieces of lots of people, but I still look around there and I think with pride that I had a little bit to do with that. So one of the things as a lawyer is you often don't get to see physical manifestations of what you've done. I mean, I love what I do, and I love all those contracts to look nice and neat, and I see the document books and everything. But
business changes hands, and it still looks the same on the facade.
But to see a physical manifestation, whether it's whether I go up to Whistler and I drive along the Sea to Sky Highway, or I go to a hospital or a school or something that I was involved in, it's really satisfying. It justifies the hard work. And I think the airport was one of the first transactions where I felt that so strongly, that airport completely changed as a result of that transaction. It just opened up the door for it to be the amazing international airport that it is still now.
It's interesting to listen to you speak about how important relationships are, and then to hear about how the moments that you're proud of come from these relationships that have continued through your whole career. I think thinking maybe on this career as a whole, do you have any advice you'd share with law students who might be listening to this interview?
I think I've thrown a couple of things in as we went along. Be open to change. Don't be too fixed in your ideas. The areas of my specialty have really focused. I knew right from the beginning I wanted to be a solicitor. I have a lot of experience in buying and selling businesses, in financing large transactions, but the nature of the transactions changed. You know, because of RIVTO, I was doing marine stuff and equipment businesses, and then some of the equipment businesses were sold, and I moved on to do a different type of business, and then you move on again and do a different type of business. So it was still buying and selling businesses, but they all had different focuses, and so each time you do a transaction, some of the legal principles that I was putting in were the same, but I had to learn a lot about that business, and that was really exciting for me, and clients love talking to you about their businesses. So I guess I would say keep your mind open to where your career may take you, and don't be afraid to try some different things. Don't be afraid to ask clients lots of questions. I can remember one client that I had, and he was a chartered accountant. He was the president of the company, and he spoke in paragraphs. He didn't speak in words or sentences. He spoke in paragraphs. And we were out for dinner one night. We'd had a whole bunch of meetings about a transaction, and we were talking, and he was going on about some really complicated financial statement principles as a chartered accountant. And I was getting lost. And so sometimes you just have to suck it up and say, I have no idea what you're talking about. And I said, whoa, stop. This is important. I really want to know this. I want to understand this. Can we just go way back, and will you just walk me through this again? If I asked him today if he remembered that dinner, he would say yes. Because here he had somebody who really wanted to learn what he wanted, what he was willing to teach and had the ability to teach. So if you don't understand something, there are times when you have to kind of play it off a little bit and then go and ask a more senior lawyer, okay, I didn't understand that, can you explain it? A lot of the times, if it's to do with the business or if it's to do with something that's not pure law, ask the clients. They love talking about their businesses. That's really exciting, and it will be fascinating for you. You'll learn something, and they'll enjoy it too. Another piece of advice I guess I would give, and I've given this before, is that if you're in a meeting and you have some thoughts, even as a really young lawyer, don't be afraid to participate in the discussion. Just because you're the young person in the room doesn't mean you have to sit there. I can remember lots of times as a young lawyer saying, well, you know, we're trying to talk about solutions to a particular problem, and sort of saying, well, you know, this may not work, but have you thought of X? So the reaction would be one of two. One possibility would be, yes, we thought about X, it doesn't work because, in which case there were two results. One, they knew I was listening, they knew I cared enough to think about X, and they knew that I now knew why X didn't work, so I had learned something. The other possibility would be, and this happened a few times, and it again is extremely satisfying, no, we hadn't thought of X. That's a great idea, let's just see if this will work. And you're going, yes, I did it. You know, makes all those long meetings totally worthwhile. So yeah, some advice. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't be afraid to seek out advice of others. And another one I did mention earlier is find your champions. Your champions can be other lawyers in your office. They can be friends, although I'm thinking more of either clients or lawyers. Lawyers in other offices, often will get people in other firms phoning me and saying, look, I know you've got experience in this. Can you help me? I guess that's not quite as much a champion as just helping somebody, but really find your champions. In firms like this firm, which is big, you don't want to get lost, and so it's those champions that will you know, rally around you and support you and make sure that others know what a great job you're doing. So look out and find them, and you may find them in places you don't quite expect.
That's all great advice. I think I'm going to definitely be following a couple of those pieces. I guess my last question would be, do you have anything else to add?
I would just like to take this opportunity to tell you a little bit about a project that we have going out at the law school. It's the Law Students Emergency Fund. It's been going for several years, and it's something that I started and I'm really proud of. So far, most of the funding for it has come from me. There was a little bit left over from my law school reunion, so we put that into the fund as well. But what it is, it's not a regular scholarship or bursary that somebody applies for in advance and they find out in the summer before school that they're going to get. The idea is for an emergency fund. So it's a student who runs into something unexpected during law school that either might stop them from continuing school or make it difficult for them to continue school. So the idea is that they can go and try and get some money from this fund. It's done on a very quick basis. If someone comes to the people in the law school and say, look, I've got a problem, and talks to somebody and it's considered a proper cause, they can have the money within a few days.
Wow.
So it's not a long, drawn-out process. It's been set up to deal with these situations very, very quickly. So the thought behind that, or the situation that started it, was an example of someone, a young woman with two young kids in first year, and the beginning of first year, husband was supposed to sort of look after the kids, didn't have a lot of family in the area, and at the beginning of first year, her husband left, and she was left with really no one to turn to and was thinking she was going to have to drop out of law school. Now, the fund wasn't set up at that time, so I wish I knew what happened to her, but I unfortunately I don't. But that was the story that I heard that led me to think that we needed something like this in the law school as a, basically as a safety net. So it does go through, starts with the faculty, it does go through the development office at UBC, but it is set up to deal with issues very quickly. And I've had some absolutely amazing letters from people. Some of them know who I am, some of them don't. I don't know the recipients of it. They can be kept anonymous if they want it. And it's just been something that's been really exciting to be part of. So we're trying to keep that going and trying to make it grow. Some years we've used all the money, some years we haven't. So it's just something that I'm really proud of as a bit of a legacy to the law school.
That's
and
amazing.
My law firm actually put in $25,000, or they're going to be $5,000 a year for the next 5 years to help that as well. And then I'm continuing to fund it, and I'm working on some other sources as well. So that's
amazing.
Yeah, it is. It's something I think it's really important. I've never heard it done elsewhere. I've spoken to people in the Faculty of Medicine and said, look, why don't you guys do the same thing? And they thought that it's a great idea. But so far, I'm not sure. I haven't heard of it anywhere else. And I just think it's a really, really good idea. Sometimes you just need that little safety net. That woman in the example I gave, she just needed someone to help her look after her kids for a little while so she could establish other arrangements for them. But it easily could have kept her from continuing law school.
Yeah.
So anyhow, that was the idea. So wanted to share that. I guess the other thing that I would like to just tell you is how happy I am that you're doing this project. I think it's really important that some of these stories be preserved. It's an amazing institution. I am so proud to have gone there. And there were some really fun times, there were some interesting times, and some real characters have gone through that law school, and I do think that history should be preserved.
Awesome. Thank you so much for sharing what you remember from that history today.
Oh, I remember way more, but I probably shouldn't share it all. Thank you.
Thanks again.